Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
It does show the sort of strain that the market is under this winter.
It's very rare to hear the chief economist of the Bank of England being so frank about Brexit.
I think that what's more problematic for policy in the UK is following these basics so that people make decisions on the basis of the full picture.
Stephen, I would like to have a small rant.
Oh, just a small one. That's a relief.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepker.
I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the programme. I have to say, I didn't get up to much this weekend, but I think if I were to scan the internet, the probably words that would stand out would be King, arrests, sword, and Penny Mordaunt. Did I miss anything?
Triceps. Penny's triceps.
Triceps. Well, same to you. It seems to have all gone off very well.
Yes, millions watched. I followed it throughout the weekend, of course. The service at Westminster Abbey, the golden carriage, the dresses, the BBC coverage. I think what I pull out, though, of the 3 days, the volunteering, the street parties and bunting, it's pomp and ceremony amidst the cost of living crisis. It's the storied history and yet the reckoning with empire. And I think one word sticks in my mind, duality. You've got kind of the renewal of the crown and yet with the oldest person to come to the throne ever. And it's the tension, I think, in modern Britain that exists between the very religious service that we saw on Saturday and yet largely, you know, not very religious British population. Mm. I think there are real tensions also to do with the legacy that it is attached to the crown and yet how that crown is taken forward.
But I do think that there's a way of handling that duality. You heard from Wes Streeting of the Labour Party on the Sunday shows on Laura Koonsberg's programme on the BBC, and he said you don't need to be defensive about Britain's imperial past. You just need to accept it and be open about it in a matter-of-fact way.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet there are so many tensions, though. I mean, for example, Prince William talked about, you know, for all the celebrations being magnificent, at the heart of the pageantry is a simple message, service. And yet again, that might clash with the kind of opulence, actually, of the military parade, of the golden carriage, and so on. So I think there are many kind of tensions here.
Was it not the big shrug that everyone sort of expected it to be? I feel like there was a certain part that people were expecting it to be nothing, but actually in the end sort of talked of nothing else.
Yeah, and I think it is still hugely important. I think that's, yes, there are generational splits, and absolutely younger people were less interested, I think, than older generations maybe. But actually, you're right. I think people
it was compelling in the end. I think anyone that sort of caught any part of it was sort of drawn in, even if it was just Penny Mordaunt carrying a heavy sword.
Well, there were moments when you wondered whether King Charles himself was getting a bit bored. Did you see the lip reading of him in the carriage?
No.
Looking grumpy, perhaps complaining that the onlookers were getting bored because it was going on too long.
I mean, to be fair, as someone who naturally looks either bored or angry, I have sympathy with the fact that perhaps that might be just a default position.
Resting bored face.
Exactly. Thank you for cleaning that up and me not saying the original expression, which I think is helpful.
In terms, though, also, amidst sort of this, it did seem like something of a of a pause. Yes, there is obviously politics involved in Charles being crowned and he's the head of state. But I think there was also a pause because the local election results were so poor for the Conservative Party. And again, I'll point to this other duality. Rishi Sunak in Westminster giving a reading, obviously, as Prime Minister. But then, as you say, Penny Mordaunt being hotly tipped as a potential future leader. So there's that kind of political tension of which MPs also attended and you know, which were kept out for kind of numbers reasons. I think there are lots of tensions there too.
Yeah, certainly is. Well, look, let's turn to the local election results then. Rishi Sunak's Tories never expected success at the polling last week, but the final result was worse than pollsters' bleakest predictions, a loss of more than 1,000 seats. It's now time for the post-mortem. Conservative MPs cannot seem to agree on the diagnosis of what went wrong. Well, for some analysis, we're joined now by Leonora Campbell, who's Bloomberg's UK government reporter on the Daily Readout newsletter, well worth a subscription, and also in a previous life was a special advisor to Rishi Sunak and to Boris Johnson. Leonora, welcome to the programme. Great to have you.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Us.
The first of many.
Look, the Prime Minister's doubled down on his message that to win the general election, he needs to focus on delivering on his five priorities, including halving inflation and growing the economy. Does that risk appearing a bit tone deaf? He hasn't changed that messaging since January, despite this defeat.
Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to see what comes out of the next few days and whether there's a dramatic shift of approach from Number 10 and Rishi Sunak. These have been extremely dire local elections for the Conservatives. They lost 1,000 councillors, which was on much the worst end of what they were projecting and predicting. And the key thing is whether or not perhaps they bowed to some of the party, the calls to cut taxes, build more houses, build less houses, or whether or not they stick to their five priorities.
Yeah, on that housing point, it's pretty fascinating. Everybody wants more homes to be built. Some Tories say that Sunak's decision to scrap the requirement for local authorities to build, you know, the 300,000 homes a year pledge means that he doesn't care about levelling up. Sunak's likely to add housing to his list potentially then? How does he handle this, the Green Belt issue?
Yeah, there's a couple of really interesting things here. I think, first of all, you've seen a massive breakdown of party unity here. You've got one end of the party calling for fewer houses to be built, people like Theresa Villiers, the NIMBY side of the party.
Not in my backyard.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got others calling for more houses, more growth. The second thing is, I think the reason why Sunak has picked his five priorities is because they're much more easy to show delivery on than something like housing. You know, how can you show proper delivery on people being able to get onto the housing ladder between now and 2024? When you talk to internal party strategists, some of the things that they're saying is that we'll have the Tories will have to bring forward a big ticket on this in the manifesto. Whether people trust them or not is the question.
Yeah, and it's even more difficult when you've got interest rates projected to potentially hit 5% by September, that feeding into this housing crisis problem. I wonder, do you expect more from Labour on house building? It was the issue that Keir Starmer, of course, focused on at the PMQ's session the day before the polls opened.
Yeah, I think if I was sitting in Labour HQ right now, the one thing I'd want to do is to pin this failure on house building onto the Tories and to say, look, they don't do the things that they promise. And you can see a whole strategy forming out of how, you know, Tory broken promises. It's something we've seen from Keir Starmer before, and I think it's something that they could 100% major on in the way to the next election.
Because it's almost unfixable in time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The longer term issue, though, I mean, the reality other than the kind of politicking is, you know, this is a generational divide, a huge issue for younger voters. I mean, do we think that this is going to be a key general election issue? Again, along with other kind of generational issues, childcare, for example.
It really is. But I think, you know, the next election probably will be won or lost on the economy. And I think that's why Number 10 rightly has chosen to, you know, create those like the big things that they want to focus on, because that's what people care about at the end of the day. How much money will they feel they have in their pocket as they approach their election, that election, and where are we at with inflation?
But those have been the priorities since January, and yet they had this bruising defeat. Is it simply that people don't trust the Bank of England's predictions that inflation will fall by the end of the year, or is it that they're seeing these headlines about double-digit inflation? When do you think people will get on board with the idea, the prioritisation that Sunak has picked?
Yeah, I think there's a multitude of different things. The first thing to say is that it's very difficult to create a direct read across from local elections to what that might mean in a general election. People are voting for all sorts of reasons in local elections, and they're different to a general election. But also, people were reflecting in the polls that they're fed up of 13 years of Conservative governments now. That could be for all sorts of different reasons: COVID, parties, what the chaos that we saw under the Liz Truss era. And so, although part of it might be that people are feeling poorer at the moment, it is also a lot of other things as well.
I mean, is this just a completely losing battle then for Rishi Sunak and his government to be fighting? They're looking at, you know, a really very pessimistic outlook from the local elections, but can he now kind of turn things around and project the message that that's possible before a general election?
Well, I think what everyone agreed on following the local elections is that, first of all, it was a very bad night for the Tories and they are in serious electoral trouble. But I think lots of other people said that although Labour claimed this is a massive victory, actually they didn't reflect the sort of 20-point leads that I think we've been talking about this year. It was actually quite an underwhelming night for them. So although the Tories are in serious trouble, there is still a small path to turning things around. And I think what we'll see over the next kind of few weeks and months is whether Sunak decides that the best thing to do is just to carry on with the plan and show deliverability on those five key pledges.
Nobody's talking about getting rid of Rishi Sunak, which I think is perhaps a low bar versus last year, 3 PMs in 12 months. But the idea of kind of Penny Morden...
Yes. Penny back? Is this her big
yes.
moment?
she was looking spectacular, wasn't she?
Her headgear is just something else.
And I think she said she had to do lots of press-ups in preparation because it was £8, that sword. Look, I think one thing that you've seen here is that in Christmas, we were talking about the local elections being a big marker for will Boris come back. No one thinks that's actually generally really likely now. And I don't think that Sunak's position is under threat at the moment from any challenges. I think most people in the party would agree that that would cause too much chaos and make the country, which is already annoyed with the Conservatives, even more annoyed.
OK, Leonora Campbell, thank you very much for all of that, our UK government reporter on the Daily Readout newsletter.
So one of the unusual things about the local elections was that it was the first in which voters were required to produce a valid photo ID or a voter authority certificate in order to cast their ballot. Joining us now to discuss that whole process is the chief executive of the Association of Electoral Administrators, Peter Stanion. The AEA represents around 2,000 electoral officials across the UK. So Peter, great person to have on the programme to sort of help us understand how the experience went in terms of the polls that were run across the country. This is what your members administer. How did the day go?
Well, administratively, it went very well, smoothly as could be expected. It was a massive change, a sea change, with the requirement for the voter ID, photo ID, to be shown in advance, but there will have inevitably been people turned away because they had the wrong ID or didn't bring some with them. But certainly the general consensus is the system worked as smoothly as could be expected.
What did you hear from your members in terms of those experiences of people being turned away, or perhaps, you know, how people understood the regulations when they did turn up to vote?
Certainly, I think in the majority of cases, the voters arriving at the stations came prepared with their photo ID to hand. And certainly I witnessed that myself in a couple of polling stations. And it was as smooth as could be expected, only adding 10, 15 seconds to the actual voting process. However, there were reported instances of there being some disgruntlement where people were turned away. And certainly we can understand the frustration, but the volunteers in the polling stations had to deal with that in terms of the rules are now the rules, and they had to turn people away because of wrong ID or no ID at all.
So, Peter, you say it went as smoothly as can be expected, but is there anything that you'd do differently in the future, or that other people could do better in the future?
It's too early to say as to how the whole process worked. That's been evaluated as we speak, and we expect to hear that in the next month or so. But I think the real issue is the fact that this was a local election with a turnout of 35-40% across 230 local authorities in England. When this rolls out at the next UK parliamentary general election across the whole of the UK, it will be a different ballgame because turnout will be higher, and it will be actually for the first time some individuals, certainly in Scotland, for example, having to roll it out live at a parliamentary. So there's lots of things still to learn simply by the numbers who will come through and the hope that the message is there, that they actually understand they still need that ID for all those elections.
Was this policy necessary? Was there any evidence of either, you know, a large amount of voter fraud or an increasing amount of voter fraud that means that ID is required?
Well, the government brought it through as a manifesto commitment. There isn't evidence of there being widespread prosecutions for personation, as it's known, in polling stations. But the decision was taken by the government and then passed through Parliament for the change to the legislation to come in. So ultimately, those in the polling stations and the AA members must deliver what the law actually says.
So is this an Americanisation of our voting system? Was it even necessary?
I can't really get into the whys and wherefores of whether it was necessary, other than to say it was something that Parliament voted through to make that change. As I say, the evidence of prosecutions is very low, but the arguments put were very much about the perception of fraud. And now the system's been brought in and we rolled out at parliamentary elections as much as locals as we go forwards.
I hear your caution about what the next general election might look like. What needs to change between now and then, or what tweaks need to be made to the system before it can be rolled out for an election that's going to have a lot more voters?
Well, there's a slight leeway. If a general election is called immediately, there won't be voter ID. It will only kick into force at a UK parliamentary general election from, I believe, it's October onwards. So I think, again, slightly too early to say, because the evaluations need to be done. The stats need to be taken in from the various polling stations as to the effect of the impact of voter ID in the stations. And following on from that, it will then be determined whether changes are actually needed or whether it's simply a case of raising awareness of the need to bring that photo ID with you to stations for elections from here on.
There is a great deal of focus in democratic countries on voting, on influence, on the running of elections. Is the UK good at this in general? I mean, I'm sure that you will say that we are. Are there any further policy changes that might be on the way in terms of making sure that elections in you know, obviously a democratic country, are well run?
You take the words out of my mouth. I think elections in the UK are run very, very well, to very high standards, under a great deal of pressure. I think the one big change that is needed is simplification. It's fair to say that the existing legislation that we're working with was initially drafted in 1872 in the Ballot Act, when secrecy of voting came in, and has been morphed onto with various changes over the intervening years. Is it fit in terms of being what you would draw up from scratch now? No. Does it work? Yes. But it works in some cases despite the legislation. It's very much a case of trying to deliver a system. It is fair, it is sound, it is actually accurate, but it's a creaking system as we go forwards that is crying out for simplification.
So what needs to change then?
Well, there are innumerable forms of secondary, primary legislation, different election rules for different elections. It's really trying to bring it back to the modernising legislation to make it, to keep it fit for purpose. It is fit for purpose now. It's just making sure that we can ensure that as things change, as expectations of voters change, the system can keep pace, at the same time allowing accessibility, at the same time as ensuring that the elections are quite rightly seen as being fair, free from fraud and things like that.
How far do you think we are from not having to go into a voting booth at all, but simply doing it electronically, you know, over your phone or your computer? Or, I mean, we have postal voting, obviously, but how far do you think we are from actually the physicality of the vote disappearing?
At this moment in time, I think we're still quite a long way away from that. There is no appetite in Parliament, as far as I can ascertain, to moving to different forms of voting, whether it be electronic, internet, etc. That's despite the fact that on the electoral registration side, you can now register to vote online. You can, with very short, be able to apply for a postal vote online. So technology is coming into elements of the electoral process, but the actual process of voting still seems to be wedded with a stubby pencil and a piece of paper, which works and is a very safe way of doing it. But is it the most accessible form for all electors? That's a question that the decision makers need to consider as they go forwards.
Okay, Peter Stanion, the Chief Executive of the Association of Electoral Administrators, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, so let's change tack. Britain's manufacturers are calling for an independent investigation, a Royal Commission on Industrial Strategy, to try to end what they call the flip-flopping on UK policy and also to drive economic growth. This is Make UK, of course, that represents manufacturers. They've done a survey and they talk about a majority of companies believing that there has never been a long-term government vision for manufacturing in the country, and they contrast that with other major economies, including the US, China and Germany. Now, we were talking to the Make UK Chief Operating Officer Ben Fletcher about this and why he thinks it's so important that there is this powerful independent investigation to give new recommendations.
Part of the argument here is about the seriousness of manufacturing to the UK economy, the significance of manufacturing to the UK economy, and actually the need to have a plan that transcends political boundaries. I think a Royal Commission is one of the few ways that we've got in the UK to oversee and supplement the parliamentary process in an effective way, but achieve that kind of consensus. And I think ultimately the vehicle is slightly less important than the ambition, which is to say, we haven't grown our manufacturing sector in the way they have in Germany, in the way that they're really focused on doing at the moment in the US. And one of those reasons is that we haven't had that long-term vision. And this is a route way to get it.
This is a real damning indictment, frankly, of government policy for 20 years.
I think that actually underneath, there's quite a lot of support for government policy. We had a very good industrial strategy that was launched at the end of 2017, early 2018. There's some really good things that came out of that. As an example, what many people don't know is that we're one of the biggest aviation manufacturers in the world. And one of the great things that came out of that industrial strategy was investment into firms, which mean we're now the best and the biggest producer of airplane wings anywhere in the world. And we've created fantastic resources that build as we move to net zero and tackle that challenge. Incredibly lightweight, but incredibly strong wings without metal. So there is some success, but the damning indictment is really that we haven't built on that success. We haven't continued to invest in the way that we've done before. And many of the real strategic benefits that came from that plan have dissipated. And I think that's the really crucial issue. Even when we've had success, we haven't recognized it. We haven't lauded it. We haven't built that confidence that allows firms to invest. And we've chopped and changed so much that those benefits haven't been built upon.
When you look towards Germany and its success, there are three things that would be very controversial in the UK if we were to introduce. Firstly, they have selective, essentially grammar school system, where they send people down a different path at the age of 10, 11, 12. Secondly, they have quite amenable tax regime for people inheriting their companies, where if you're dedicating a certain proportion of your revenue to pay for employees, personnel costs, then your inheritance tax is reduced every year to the point that ultimately you will end up paying very little inheritance tax. That's what companies say gives them a long-term perspective and lets them invest in the future. And thirdly, of course, Germany is still in the European Union. If you look at those three things, are any of them feasible for the UK if we're going to try to imitate some of Germany's success?
I don't think we're saying that any model is something that we should look to exactly replicate here. You know, there's some really interesting comparisons with the US at the moment where none of those things apply. And through the Inflation Reduction Act, they're making a really significant investment in bringing manufacturing back. One of the things I would say that the German model, not necessarily through the question of making formal decisions or forcing anyone down that route, but one of the really interesting things about Germany is a real focus and a real prize on technical skills as well as academic and vocational skills. And I think that that is an area that we could look to emulate quite a lot from Germany, the fact that they invest in their training centres, the fact that they invest in their schools, and the fact that children are seen and see themselves as careers in manufacturing as being equally valid as careers in services industries. And I think that the technical capability at all of the tiers of the German education system is something that we absolutely should look at. Now, we're not saying copy everyone's tax regime, copy everyone's investment plan. The American plan is incredibly ambitious, would be difficult for us to do in exactly its same form at the moment. But one of the things I think that is really important is that we look around the world and see which countries do it better than us. And I think if you look at Germany, if you look at France, you've got a very, very long-term sustained plan. If you look at America, you look at a number of places in the Far East, they've all got really clear plans, and they've all got a real investment in skills and a focus on what this is going to achieve over the next 10 years. And if you compare that to where we are now, Jeremy Hunt made some really positive steps forward in the budget last autumn, some clearly defined areas that he wants to invest in. But we really need to scale up from that, and we need a huge amount more flesh on the bone in terms of detail.
Okay, a last thought then, in terms of how welcome your drive is in the corridors of power, I suppose. How does Rishi Sunak's government see this? Because obviously the Royal Commission would have to be approved and organised by government. And indeed, what of the Labour Party? I mean, we have an election, general election, looming not that long away, and the polling is very positive for the Labour Party. If they were to get in, do you think this is something that would appeal to them?
We certainly hope that both parties look at it seriously and take it seriously. To directly address your question, as I said, you know, we've had some positive signs coming out of the Sunak government, and Hunt's budget set out that ambition, and we strongly welcome that. The opposition parties, Labour in particular, has said that an industrial strategy is critical, and they would want to produce one and deliver one in government. What we're trying to do, I think, is to be a bit of a catalyst for all of that thinking. It's really critical that we get this right. We've learned some lessons from COVID, I think, about the impact if we don't have a lot of domestic capability. We're seeing the focus on net zero. We're seeing the focus on industrial growth in our big competitors. And at the moment, our plan isn't fully functional, isn't fully worked, and isn't fully resourced. So what we see is a receptive audience on both sides of the house. What we want to do is to put a turbocharger underneath that thinking and get people to realise that this isn't something you can just talk about, you really have to do.
So that was Make UK's Chief Operating Officer Ben Fletcher speaking to me and to Alex Webb there on Bloomberg Radio. Look, I think this is so important. In fact, I think Make UK gets across a really valid point, which is when you look at the chopping and changing of the government department in charge of industrial policy, when you look at the kind of different policy documents that have come out over the last 15 years, there has been a huge amount of churn. And why now? Why the importance of this now? Of course, it's the enormous amounts of money that the United States and the European Union are spending on their industrial strategies, and Britain has got to try to step up. So this is the manufacturers trying to do that.
I think it's a completely valid point, given that the industrial strategy's changed 5 times in the past 15 years. The business department's changed its name. It's merged with trade as well. But this is the same problem that there is with housing, which is the other issue we were just speaking about earlier, off the back of the local elections. When you have to make long-term policy, how do you do it unless you create another branch of government that is there beyond the life cycle of a short-term parliament?
Look, I do think, though, it also goes to the great battle, perhaps, that we are having ideologically in the world between Western democracies and more planned economies like China. You know, can democracies bring in some elements of a more planned economy for the success of their people?
And indeed, the idea of a royal commission is something that started, I think, in the 1960s and 70s, or at least it was really broadly, it was used much more then, before Margaret Thatcher came along and said, I'm not going to be as interventionist in my economic policy.
So interesting debate to watch. Well, let's turn back to the coronation now. The dust settled, of course, on the formal events. Some, though, considering what next for the monarchy in terms of the soft power that it has for Britain. Bloomberg's Eileen Bagbo reports.
King Charles III was crowned during a weekend of celebrations and some protests in an event watched by millions. With many of the world's leaders present, it was a moment for British soft power, but also of reckoning with the past. Queen Elizabeth II was viewed by many as a personification of the UK's influence on the world stage. Described by some as Britain's greatest diplomatic asset, she met with leaders from across the globe and held a unique position as the head of the Commonwealth. But, with a role built on the legacy of Britain's empire, does her passing signal the end of royal diplomacy and with it a UK edge?
I think there is value in that relationship historically. But of course, history also has its complications, given what we know about the history of colonialism and empire from the UK. So these issues are not entirely straightforward.
That's Sir Simon James Fraser, a former British diplomat who served as the permanent undersecretary at the Foreign Office. He says there is a place for the new king in the diplomatic sphere, but the path forward is not without its challenges.
The important thing is for the new king to establish, if you like, his identity as the king of the UK and therefore as the head of the Commonwealth. And that will be very important because, to be absolutely clear, a lot of this in the past was associated with the personality and the personal history of Queen Elizabeth II. So he's got to establish his own position, and that will influence how other people, how other countries, the realms and other members of the Commonwealth think about this relationship in the future.
But his view is far removed from how many around the world see the monarch and the Commonwealth as symbols of the British Empire's darkest moments. Historian Dr. Imabong Imoran is the author of Empire Without End. She says it's hard to separate royalty from the history of empire.
There are many who would say that there really is very little value in the monarchy, given the monarchy's own links directly to slavery, to colonialism, things that have really decimated the Caribbean over centuries. So I think this is also fueling these different attitudes towards the monarchy.
For his part, the new king has shown remorse for Britain's role in the slave trade, signalling his support for research into the royal family's links to it.
I cannot describe the depths of my personal sorrow at the suffering of so many as I continue to deepen my own understanding of slavery's enduring impact.
Perhaps King Charles's recent success in Germany is a taste of what is to come. Widely praised for his Bundestag speech, partly in fluent German, and diplomatic outreach post-Brexit.
Danke, danke ich Ihnen von ganzem Herzen für die außerordentliche Anteilnahme der Menschen in Deutschland.
So, there are positive signs. But with referendums on the monarchy's role planned in the Commonwealth nations, including Antigua and the Bahamas, King Charles will need to offer more of this careful diplomacy to cement the new Carolean era. In London, I'm Eileen Bagbo, Bloomberg Radio.
So Eileen Bagbo there bringing us a special report on the coronation and perhaps some of the challenges that actually King Charles has already hinted at, you know, he might be interested in getting involved in.
Yeah, really great to hear those perspectives after the weekend that we have had. Well, that is it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Walcock. Our audio engineer was Marufa Hussain. I'm Caroline Hepke.
I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.